Good afternoon, everyone. I'm Neil Love from Research to Practice, and welcome to Current and Future Integration of Antibody Drug Conjugates in the Management of Metastatic Breast Cancer. We're going to focus today on ER-positive triple-negative disease. We'll get into HER2-positive and disease and lots to say about that in terms of antibody drug conjugate in the future. We have a great faculty today, Dr. Aditya Bardia, UCLA Health Johnson Comprehensive Cancer Center, University of California, Los Angeles, and Dr. Adam Brusky from the UPMC Hillman Cancer Center in the University of Pittsburgh. So as with all of our programs, just keep in mind that what we're about to talk about will include discussion of non-FDA approved agents and regimens, so check out the package inserts for more. As we've done on so many webinars now since the beginning of the pandemic, we recruited a bunch of community-based physicians to present cases, our short videos, just a minute and a half or 2 minutes. We have six cases we've pulled today. So appreciative to these docs for doing that, and they always bring up things I've never thought of. So I'm really going to make rounds here today with these cases. In between, we're going to actually go through some data as well. And although we're not going to emphasize the slides, if you want to check them out in more detail, just we have the slide set in the chat room. So I just want to begin and talk a little bit before we get into metastatic disease and ADCs. Aditya, I wanted to talk a little bit about localized disease and ADCs, as we have the ESMO meeting now coming up in a couple of weeks. We saw at the last ASCO meeting, of course, the DB09 study, first-line therapy of T-DXd. With a PFS advantage, so much to talk about there. But then we saw this press release from the DB Breast 11 study looking at PATH CR in patients with getting neoadjuvant T-DXd. That's going to be presented at ESMO. And also, as I just found out, also in the same session at ESMO, in another great presentation we've been looking toward for a long time, T-DXd versus T-DM1, and we have this press release. Not a huge surprise, but it's really great to see this. It'll be interesting to see what happens in terms of toxicity, but these two big and a lot of other stuff coming out at ESMO. And, it brings up the whole issue of using ADCs in the localized disease setting. We're going to talk about TROP2 ADCs as well here today. You see their trials with now the approved TROP2 agent, Dato-DXd. Also with sacituzumab govitecan and another TROP2 ADC that we have trials going on in the neoadjuvant and the adjuvant setting. Also sac-TMT, a third is currently unapproved in the United States, TROP2 ADC. They have trials also looking at localized disease. And Aditya, I'm just kind of curious what you're looking for to see with some of these presentations. I guess one issue is when we start talking about, at least in terms of HER2 disease, a localized disease, you're talking about people who have the potential to cure, although, of course, with post-neoadjuvant, that is not the greatest prognosis. We do have the ILD issue. It'll be very interesting to see what happens there with these trials. Any thoughts about where we're going to be in the next 6 months, the next few months, Aditya, in terms of ADCs and localized disease, and where do you see things heading in the future in that regard?
Yeah, absolutely. We've seen success with ADCs in metastatic disease, and now we are seeing positive studies in the adjuvant, neoadjuvant setting as well. And in general, these ADCs are replacing chemotherapy. As we look at these study results, DESTINY-Breast05, DESTINY-Breast11, as well as the other studies, I think there are three important components we need to consider. The first is the population. So like for DESTINY-Breast05, it was patients who had high risk of recurrence. Those who had positive lymph nodes at the time of surgery or at baseline did not have operable disease. So ensuring that we understand the eligibility criteria for these studies, it's not for everyone, but those specific patient population. And also looking at the control arm, like in DESTINY-Breast11, it was ACTHP that was the control arm. Often we use TCHP in the neoadjuvant setting. So these nuances related to study population, the control arm, are important to consider. The second one would be the magnitude of benefit as compared to the investigation study, investigation arm versus the control arm. And then finally, the side effect profile, as you were reviewing, this is the curative setting. Pneumonitis is an important side effect to monitor with T-DXd. When we talk about SG, Dato-DXd, other AEs. So looking at not just the efficacy, but also the study population, control arm, as well as the safety profile would be critical as we evaluate these trials.
So Adam, of course, we see ADCs in so many different solid and hematologic cancer, diffuse large B-cell lymphoma, for example, upfront polatuzumab. And it seems like over and over we're seeing ADCs have better efficacy than chemotherapy, systemic chemotherapy, kind of the promise of the Trojan horse kind of idea. Is that sort of is that what you generally expect when you see trials that are going to compare an ADC to chemotherapy? And do you think that in general ADCs are better tolerated than systemic chemo, Adam?
It's a good question. I think it really depends on the ADC. But Neil, I would agree with you. I think that the therapeutic index of an ADC is probably better. I mean, that's the whole idea behind it, you know, is that it delivers chemo in a higher level in the intracellular space, intratumoral space, and not to the circulation itself. Although I think that you would agree as well that there is substantial leakage, you know, of the payload into the blood, into the serum, causing some of these side effects. But nonetheless, I think that the expectation is that for the vast majority of these agents, they should perform as well, if not better, than chemo. And I'm sure we're going to get into this a little bit later. I think the big problem with ADCs that I see is that we don't really understand the mechanisms of resistance. I think that it's almost like the three-body problem in physics. That's what they call it now, you know, because it's like, you know, we're dealing with three things, a payload, a linker, and an antibody. And this, the resistance could be from any one of the three. And I think it's really difficult to kind of know a priori what the toxicity as well as the resistance mechanisms are going to be. But nonetheless, I think clearly the therapeutic index is better with ADCs than with standard chemo.
And of course, as you know, all parts of oncology are always in a situation where you have to indirectly compare treatments, indirectly compare ADCs rather than directly. Although we have an example right here that we just talked about, T-DXd versus T-DM1, where we know from second-line metastatic setting, clearly T-DXd had greater efficacy, and it sounds like we're going to see the same thing in the localized setting. So as you said, it's not 100% clear exactly how these agents are working. All right, well, let's start getting into a nitty-gritty of taking care of patients. And this first case is amazing. We've talked so many times about this. And it never fails that somebody brings up a case and it's something I never thought about before. So we've talked about, you know, the idea of ADC versus chemotherapy. But this is in a situation with somebody who has visceral crisis, which I have not had a patient like this presented before. And I think a very interesting situation. I'm sure it happens every day, but I'm really looking forward to hear what you have to say. But this is Dr. Eric Fox, who have this 78-year-old lady who walked into his office who was not looking very good. His patient had had multiple lines of therapy. She'd been on CDK inhibitor, et cetera, for ER-positive disease, and now walked in looking pretty sick. Here's the case.
She developed a rapid growth of disease in July of 2024. You can see her imaging here. She had a left upper lobe mass. She had bronchial occlusion, vascular encasement, and large hilar mediastinal and chest wall invasion. And this was a relatively frail patient who came to the office complaining of a cough. She was losing weight and having a cough because the way those scans looked and the burden of disease in this lady who couldn't have been more than 80 pounds, I was highly concerned about her. And I sort of did consider this to be a visceral crisis patient. We ended up being able to get approval for sacituzumab, and she did great for pretty much a full year on treatment. Immediately, the cough improved. Immediately, her scans got better, and she started eating and gaining weight. I would say after probably 4 to 5 weeks of treatment, her cough went away. I followed her very, very closely clinically to see what her cough was doing, you know, in the days to weeks after initiating therapy. And I was thankful that she did have a vast improvement of those symptoms. And then my questions for the experts are in a case like this, when you're managing patients that you consider to be in visceral crisis that are hormone positive, how are they approaching patients like this? We always think about the answer being chemotherapy, but with effective antibody drug conjugate therapy now, like sacituzumab and T-DXd, is there a role for going there first? I was quite concerned about the burden of pulmonary disease with exposing the patient to T-DXd. So does either malignancy-related lung disease or, you know, pre-existing COPD or other lung disease impact that decision in a case like this? And I wasn't faced with that at that time, but would you give dato here, especially in the setting of someone who's acutely ill walking into the office and, you know, has very sort of scary radiology reports with vascular encasement and you need a response quickly from?
What's your experience been with sacituzumab?
My experience has been fantastic, actually. The main thing was blood counts requiring G-CSF. She never had a neutropenic sepsis or an admission to the hospital. She's had no GI toxicities, no skin toxicities. And that's generally been my experience with the drug.
So, Adam, I was joking with the two of you that every single one of these cases is HER2 low, whether they got T-DXd or not. I don't think HER2 zero exists anymore. I just never thought about the fact you have a really sick patient in front of you. You know, this kind of almost reminds me of some of the stories that go back and forth, but, or trials looking at hormones versus chemo in patients like this. But now we're talking about chemo, systemic chemo versus an ADC in this situation. He even brings up the possibility of dato, not just what he gave the patient, SASE. Have you faced this situation, Adam, and any thoughts about it?
So again, what I'm not clear from this case is what her prior treatment was and the pace of the disease before this. I'm assuming this was someone who had already been treated with a variety of anti-hormonal therapies and targeted agents, potentially like a CDK4/6 inhibitor, maybe had a cycle or two of some sort of chemo, maybe, you know, capecitabine
and a bunch of hormones.
And now presents with visceral crisis. Yeah, it's a really interesting question. I mean, I think that, you know, I would agree that, you know, I would potentially move for an ADC here. You know, I think Aditya can really talk to this. He presented some data kind of on the speed of response and in patients with, I think it was at last San Antonio, Aditya, if I'm not mistaken.
Correct.
You know, the speed of response with these agents and people who are actually, you know, at high risk of progression fairly quickly and getting responses in them. So I like this here. I don't have a problem with this at all. I think that, again, what we worry about with the ADCs is toxicity. I personally am someone who had pulmonary issues from the disease. I don't have a problem giving a T-DXd if I had to. I understand why Eric wanted to give SASE, and I don't have a problem with that either. Dato, you know, I can go either way. I think that's really, I think, the big difference between the two is that there is a small incidence, and again, Aditya can talk to this better than I can, of ILD with dato. And I think that that's why I think the choice of SASE here is actually a good one. And I've had responses like this as well with fairly substantial, not to the point of pulmonary collapse like this, but people with substantial disease in the lungs, I've had fairly nice responses with SASE. Like Eric has shown here.
Aditya, any thoughts?
I agree with what Adam has said. It's good that this patient received ADC. Whenever I'm thinking of chemo, that's when I think of ADC as well. So clinically, if I'm going to consider chemo, that's where ADC should be considered. You could have considered T-DXd. The lung disease does not dissuade me because we've seen that from the lung trials and other studies that it's per se not a risk factor. If someone has COPD, yes. If someone does not have like normal lung reserve, that's a risk factor, but lung disease per se is not. But SG is very reasonable and good to see the response in this patient.
What about the issue of speed of response, systemic chemo versus ADC, Aditya?
It's faster. We've seen higher response rate as well as the time to response being shorter as well with ADC. For example, in DESTINY-Breast06, the response rate to T-DXd was 60%, while the response rate to capecitabine or taxane was 30%. So with ADCs in general, we see faster, more durable and higher rate of responses.
So let's just take a look at a few slides and we'll go on to another case. So Adam, of course, at this point, we're talking about TROP2 ADCs. As we mentioned, now there are three in play, two already approved in breast cancer. We've had the data out there on triple negative disease with sacituzumab for a while. Very great results in terms of not only PFS, but survival benefit. Also, this data, I think this was Aditya's data, looking at response based on TROP2. And this comes up in one of the cases later, but as long as we have the slide up here, Aditya, what's the bottom line here? Or do you think that, you know, maybe a better assay, or is there a correlation? Do you think there's a correlation between benefit with the amount of HER2 and T-DXd, for example, you know, ultra-low, low, and HER2, you know, HER2 positive? Do you think that kind of gradient theoretically would exist with TROP2, Aditya?
No, neither with HER2 nor with TROP2. We don't see strong association between expression and outcomes. But if you compare the extremes, tumors with high expression versus very low expression, you do see a difference in terms of magnitude of benefit. But for clinicians, the question is, should we be using this for selection of ADCs? And the answer is no at this time, because even in patients who have low expression of, say, HER2 or TROP2, the benefit with the ADC is higher than that of chemo. So we are not using it in clinical practice. We don't check for TROP2 before using SG or Dato-DXd.
So, Adam, this is the phase 3 TROPICS-02 study now looking at ER-positive HER2-negative disease. We just talked about triple-negative disease. And again, you see a benefit. Again, it's kind of, it's a different trial of different patients in terms of what's seen, at least indirectly. It doesn't look like maybe the survival benefit is great, but I don't know if you can really compare it. Do you think there's a difference in these TROP2 ADCs based on, in terms of their efficacy, Adam, based on whether it's ER positive or ER negative?
Probably not. I mean, I think that we just have more data with SG and triple negative disease right now than data. We don't have the TROPICS trial yet. I mean, the TROPION trial yet for triple negative disease. I know you can't talk about when that's going to be. You know, he's smiling. He knows it's going to be sometime soon, but we don't know. But we don't have that data yet. And so without that data in triple negative, we really kind of, SG is really right now for the triple negative HER2 zero patients, which are probably about 2/3, I think, of all triple negative patients. You know, we really are using SG. We're all more familiar with it. Going back to TROPION Breast-02, I think two things that are really interesting about this data, and I really have tried to push Gilead a little bit to give us some more data on it. You know, what I think is really happening, even though, you know, the response rate isn't that much different, I mean, it's 21% versus 7% in this very, very advanced population. I mean, we're doing a randomized trial in fifth-line therapy. Who would have thought that? I mean, I started this business 30 years ago. I'm a little older than Aditya. But I think that who would have thought we'd be doing a trial, a randomized study as fifth-line therapy? And I think what may be happening here is that we all have these patients who are right on the borderline of liver failure. Maybe they're, you know, a lot of liver disease. Maybe the bilirubin is 2, 1.5, kind of going up. And if we don't treat them properly, you know, maybe 2 or 3 months later, the bilirubin is 8. And there's nothing you can do anymore because you're very limited on what you can do. And I think maybe what's happening in the study, and I'd love to hear your opinion on this, is that maybe what's happening to improve the survival is that you're somehow stabilizing their liver. And even though you're not getting a true response, maybe you get a little bit of a response, I think maybe by stabilizing their liver, they're going to live a little bit longer. The patient's going to live a little bit longer than 20 or 30% of patients that really have some sort of response to this. I think that's probably what's happening in TROPICS-02. I'm curious, what do you think? Did you think that's probably, I don't know if they ever did that. We ever looked at that, you know, in TROPICS-02 to see whether it was really liver that responded as opposed to other organs?
Yeah, not to my knowledge. I've not seen that.
Go ahead.
I was saying, not to my knowledge, I've not seen the data, but you are right. The overall survival magnitude was much higher as compared to the PFS magnitude.
Right.
And it'll be interesting to look at the subgroup analysis of patients with liver mets.
So let's. I want to bring up also the other approved agent, at least in terms of HR positive, HER2 negative, with Dato-DXd. Could be in the near future we're going to see the same issue with triple negative disease if that's positive in terms of Dato versus SASI. We have the TROPION-Breast01 study, which is really how this got approved. Again, a PFS benefit. At this point, not a survival benefit. Different toxicity profile than sacituzumab. We'll get into that later, as well as deciding between the two. And then this other agent I mentioned came out of Asia. I call it SAC-TMT. Similarly positive looking initial trial. They're not quite as mature. There's going to be a presentation at ESMO of the phase 3 OptiPro-Breast02 study. Didi, any comments about SAC-TMT data and sacituzumab sort of broadly in terms of this scenario of a recurrent metastatic disease?
Yeah, all three TROP2 ADCs, but interestingly, have a different side effect profile. With SG, we see neutropenia, we see diarrhea, we see alopecia. With Dato-DXd, we see more mucositis and keratitis. And with SAC-TMT, is somewhere in between. You don't see that degree of neutropenia like SG, but you see some mucositis, you see some diarrhea. So it's good to have options because they have different side effect profile. So it's important to discuss this if these are available with patients.
So let's go on to another case. This is Dr. Zhu, who has a 61-year-old woman. First NTRK positive patient I've heard about in breast cancer. I don't know whether either the faculty have ever seen an NTRK patient. Unfortunately, this patient didn't respond, but she did try larotrectinib. And again, like every one of these patients, she was HER2 low, but this patient actually got T-DXd. And again, these docs bring up things I've never thought about. So here's Dr. Zhu.
The first CT scan, when I restaged her 3 months later, showed progressive disease, unfortunately. And because her next-gen sequence was showing this interesting NTRK rearrangement, we decided to try to target that. We used larotrectinib as a second-line option, which she tolerated amazingly but did not work. At the same time, the patient was also asking me a question. She was like, "Doctor, do you really have to wait 3 months with a CT scan to know my treatment is not working? Is there another way you can monitor and know that sooner than the CT scans?" So at that time, I said, "No, maybe we can try to use a circulating tumor DNA because your traditional tumor marker, CA15-3, is normal." So we tried that. And this is a circulating tumor DNA we use. We only have 2 data points. The one in November was at the beginning of me starting her on the T-DXd, and the one in December was after 2 treatment.
Has she had any side effects from the T-DXd?
So far, no, actually. She's tolerating very well. Actually, her cough resolved with T-DXd treatment.
Any questions about T-DXd, HER2 low, picking up interstitial lung disease?
I listened to some other podcast that you had. Sounds like the CT scan and symptoms are the only way that is valid to monitor for interstitial lung disease. And I was actually very happy her cough resolved on the treatment. My question, number one, is that would the expert panel feel like T-DXd in this setting is the most reasonable options? How do they consider other treatment options like sacituzumab versus T-DXd? And for breast cancer patient with a target mutation, in this case, it's NTRK rearrangement, how do you sequence that versus chemotherapy?
So just a reminder, this patient was triple negative. So Aditya, actually, interestingly, and just as we were here, bringing this case on, Sarah in the chat room has a patient with ER positive HER2 zero metastatic disease who's gotten ribo, abema, and has an FGFR mutation. Wants to know about using erdafitinib or an FGR inhibitor. So, Aditya, any experience with NTRK inhibitors or FGFR inhibitors in breast cancer?
The former, yes. It's interesting to hear about this case. We had a patient with NTRK fusion triple negative breast cancer, which is more common in a secretory type of triple negative breast cancer. And that patient did not have response to SG, but then got NTRK inhibitor, and that worked very well. And we have a case report that's published in Therapeutics Advances in Medical Oncology describing that case, because the secretory carcinoma was missed by the pathologist. But when the NTRK fusion was seen, the team went back and said, oh, this is mixed. This patient has both ductal and secretory component. For this patient with HER2-low disease, I guess it's reasonable to consider T-DXd, but I would personally have tried the NTRK inhibitor first, like the physician did for this patient.
So, Adam, any thoughts about cell-free DNA? That's one way to raise everybody's blood pressure, is bring up cell-free DNA in a breast cancer conference. I'm surprised somebody in the chat room hasn't brought it up already, but what about this issue? I can understand, you know, patients sitting there waiting for 3 months to get a scan. Maybe they're feeling worse. Maybe they're feeling better. What do you think about this idea of looking at cell-free DNA quantitatively, Adam?
I think it's a good idea. I think that, again, we need data. Obviously, we're data-driven. I think what we're trying to do, in breast cancer in particular, sometimes it progresses slowly, and patients have a lot of symptoms that you don't really see on scans, especially in breast cancer to bone. Bone is very difficult to image progression. And I think SERENA-6, which I think we're not really going to talk about today, does show proof of principle that treating at ctDNA change, in that case it was circulating ESR1, but it could have been rising ctDNA, I think may actually be better than waiting for the scans. And you know, what we're trying to do is, a patient comes in with symptoms, we're trying to make the symptoms better, potentially make them live longer, but at least palliate them. And, you know, waiting for scans, if a patient obviously is feeling worse, coughing more, and the scans look the same, you know, we may need some other way of measuring it. The issue is, for all of us in the breast cancer business, what the quality of the data is. And I think we're all very kind of, you know, up in the air about this now. I think using this instead of tumor markers, like the physician did here, is an interesting idea. About a third of patients they have flat markers, and this patient did have flat markers, a CA15-3. And I think, you know, following the levels is something that people have thought about doing. There are data out there. Again, limited data, phase 2 data. There's really not a lot of randomized data to help us out. But some people do believe that if you do have falling ctDNA levels, that correlates with clinical benefit. Again, I think the data is very mixed. I myself in my practice have had patients ask me for this, just like this patient did ask her physician, and I have done it. So, but do I do it routinely? No. Is it part of guidelines yet? No. It's definitely a blood pressure raising conversation, as you just said.
So let's just bring out the HER2 low data, because all these cases we're going to talk about today, again, we have T-DXd versus TROP2 ADCs and other choices that have to be considered. Aditya, here's the data from last year's ASCO meeting 2024 that Dr. Srigliana presented, the DESTINY-Breast06. We're not going to show the previous DESTINY-Breast04, but here getting into HER2-low and ultra-low. One of the questions that comes up about this is, what about the hormone receptor negative HER2 ultra-low patient, Aditya? We had a patient presented on a conference we did a couple months ago who was HER2 ultra-low, but triple negative. We don't have the data. The patient had run out of options. Would you treat a patient like that? But the data looks very impressive. You know, indirectly, it looks like the lower it is, the less oppressive hazard rate, but I guess it's not exactly proportional. Pretty impressive waterfall plots. Anything you want to say about HER2 low in general, Aditya? Would you use T-DXd in a patient with ultra-low hormone receptor negative disease?
It's a discussion, so that would be off-label use of the drug. But if the patient is running out of option, obviously there's a difference between no data versus negative data. We don't have negative data to suggest that T-DXd is not effective. We just don't have any data. But if we extrapolate from ER-positive setting, and if the patient is running out of option, certainly something to consider as an off-label use.
So a quick case from the chat. We have the best chat room anywhere, faculty. And they have so many great things, I can hardly even get to all of them. Real quick, Adam, Hassan has a 48-year-old woman, 3 centimeter tumor, 2 positive nodes, ER negative, HER2 positive, gets TCHP, has a PR, but has residual disease, except it's now triple negative.
Okay.
Any thoughts?
Yeah, I think most of us still treat that patient as if she had HER2-positive disease. And I think that, you know, we follow the protocol. In that case, she would get HP to complete a year. I don't have a problem with that, especially with the PCR. You know, it would be a worse – imagine if she had residual disease.
She had residual disease. But you said she had a PCR. No, PR and 1.5 centimeter residual disease.
1.5 centimeters of triple negative disease. I still would treat her with HP. I don't know if I would add. I mean, she's got TCHP. The only thing left she would get that probably has any benefit at this point in time would potentially be AC if you really thought of her as triple negative. I mean, I would treat her with at least T-DM1, although based on the data, you know, that may be coming out at ESMO with DB05, I may give her TDXT. And in fact, TDXT likely has benefit in triple negative disease, as we saw in this other case. So I think that I still would continue to treat her as if she was HER2 positive with TDXT to complete 14 cycles. That's what I would do. I don't know about Aditya, but I just, you know, these patients that become, you know, triple negative or change their phenotype, I don't think that necessarily were obligated to change their therapy. At least that's my opinion.
Incidentally, I heard something the other day, Aditi, I hadn't heard before. I'm curious of what your experience is. Do you see ER levels drop when people are in SERDs?
Yes.
And does it come back up?
Potentially, I guess it could over time, especially if they're getting chemotherapy. We were seeing this in neoadjuvant and window of opportunity studies as well with these oral SERDs, where you had a patient, core biopsy, ER positive, gets 2 weeks of the SERD, and at the time of surgery is ER negative. And the question is, what should I do in the adjuvant setting? I would have otherwise used adjuvant endocrine therapy. So it does change with the use of these drugs.
Okay, let's get to the question of the moment, as far as I'm concerned, which obviously came out of the ASCO meeting. Dr. Tulaney, I present the ASCEND-04 data, looking at SASE Pembro in the first-line setting. And a bunch of these people had cases like that since ASCO. It's been interesting talking about what to do. We know that at the ESMO meeting, we're going to see the companion study there, looking at people who are PD-1 low, and this is going to be sacituzumab versus chemotherapy. Press release says it's a positive study. We'll see how positive. Anyhow, Dr. Astro has a 74-year-old lady who actually has triple-negative breast cancer. Had a terrible time when she got neoadjuvant KEYNOTE-522, developed a diverticular abscess, couldn't complete the therapy, and then developed a metastatic disease, at which point he had already seen the data from ASCO and was given it a lot of consideration. Here's Dr. Astro.
I gave a SASE Pembro because I saw the ASCENT-04 data. I said, all right, let's try sacituzumab pembrolizumab. Now, I've had trouble getting insurance companies to approve this, but we were able to get, you know, approval in this case. And I think she had 3 or 4 cycles, and I've got a follow-up PET CT just actually last week. And unfortunately, progressive lung mets. So the patient is devastated, and the question is, is there anything further I can do for this patient? I have Sanigardant, and she's got a significant PIK3CA, but she's triple negative. Could the faculty panel please address the role for Pembro or another checkpoint inhibitor for patients who have had Pembro or a checkpoint inhibitor in the neoadjuvant setting? If they, you know, they progress and they have, end up with metastatic disease, what do we do? With the ASCENT-04 data, is it worth trying SASE Pembro? In this case, the issue was she seemed to be responding to the Taxol Carbo Pembro, and I just had to stop it because of toxicity. When can we use another immune checkpoint inhibitor if they've already had a checkpoint inhibitor as part of a neoadjuvant regimen like KEYNOTE-522?
So, Aditi, that was the first question I had as soon as I saw those data, because I don't think there were many people that had prior IOs in Asceno 4, was what were you going to do when you have a patient? I'm curious in general how you've been thinking to do what you thought about the trial in general. A lot of people that I talked to or wanted to use it, just as you just heard Dr. Astrid, are you similarly enthusiastic about this as well as the trial coming up? And also, I think there's some data not very positive about PIK3 inhibitors and triple negative, but maybe you can educate us on that as well.
Yeah, absolutely. It was great to see the results of ASCENT-04, which showed SG Pembro is superior to chemo plus Pembro. And you're exactly right. The proportion of patients who had received prior IO was pretty small. In general, when to reuse IO, we don't have a lot of data, but we would use what we do in oncology, which is, if the disease-free interval is more than 6 months or more than 12 months, then we can reuse the same agent. So if it's been a while since the neoadjuvant adjuvant IO, is certainly reasonable to reconsider with the understanding that these antibodies hang around for longer than traditional chemotherapy. So if the patient has PD-L1 positive disease and got neoadjuvant IO, say 3 years ago, I would feel comfortable reusing it as long as the patient tolerated the IO well. Otherwise, the other option is to use them as single agent. We'll be seeing results of ASCENT-03 at ESMO, and as per press release, that's a positive study. And so it really brings up the question when we need IO versus not when we're combining these drugs with ADCs. And quickly about PIK3CA, the trial that looked at not a PI3 kinase inhibitor per se, it was an AKT inhibitor for triple negative breast cancer in patients who had PI3 kinase alteration. Ipatasertib was negative. And in general, we've not seen a lot of efficacy of PI3 kinase inhibitors in triple negative breast cancer, partly because you have concomitant P10 alterations, which causes resistance. So I would be much more enthusiastic about other agents in this setting.
So Adam, Dr. Tolini was pretty busy there at ASCO. She presented ASCENT-04, but also DB09, two ADCs, first-line therapy. And ASCO, we're going to remember for a long time. I think people are pretty familiar with the ASCENT-04 data. Anything you want to say about this trial? Does this motivate you to want to do this in general for your patients? From Adam, is this what you think is going to be your standard of care?
Yeah, it does. The issue with this trial is there were 20 patients in ASCENT-04 that had prior. Again, a very small number that were randomized, and there was no difference. And again, very, very small numbers. It's 10 patients in each arm. You can't really say too much about that, but there didn't seem to be any difference in those patients. Some of them had had prior KEYNOTE-522 like regimen, up to 2 or 3 years before. So it's interesting. I don't know what to do about someone who's had prior Pembro. I agree with Aditya that generally we wait 6 months to a year. If it's been 6 months to a year, we retreat. And that's kind of how I'm going to use this going forward. If someone is PD-1L1 positive, obviously we're going to have the ASCENT-03 data in a few weeks at ESMO. And hopefully, this will get, obviously at this point in time, we have to be clear, these are not FDA approved indications yet in the first line for either of these two regimens. But the assumption is that after ESMO, these will likely be approved by the FDA and they will be available. And I will use an ADC up front, I think, for triple negative breast cancer based on these data.
So there are a bunch of other studies looking at ADCs and immunotherapy in the first line, as we've just talked about. This is the press release that's leading up to the ESMO meeting for the companion trial in PD-1 negative patients with sacituzumab. A couple of other studies, Tropion Breast-02 as well as Breast-05, looking at Dato. And then again, SAC-TMT coming up as well. So we'll see. A bunch of this is going to be presented at the ESMO meeting. We're going to be doing a post-ESMO conference, and sounds like we better maybe increase the time to a couple hours or something. But anyhow, let's get into another case. We're going to kind of get into more granularity about this issue. And, of course, the number one thing people want to hear about, which we have alluded to but want to get into more depth, is sequencing, particularly in the HER2-low patient. Speaking of that, here's a patient of Dr. Agrawal, a 66-year-old woman with ER-negative HER2-low disease.
She was treated with lumpectomy, adjuvant chemotherapy with doxorubicin, cyclophosphamide, followed by paclitaxel, radiation, and endocrine therapy, and then later had a recurrence which biopsy confirmed to be triple negative metastatic breast cancer with bone metastases and liver metastases. The HER2 was 1+. This patient at the time initiated palliative chemotherapy with capecitabine and at time of progression of disease was treated with sacituzumab govitecan. She had an excellent response and stayed on that agent for 4 years.
Wow. How did she do while she was on? That's a long time.
She did very well. We did have to dose reduce, but despite dose reduction, she had very good disease control for a long period of time. It really exceeded my expectations in terms of how that would perform.
I guess so. How did she do in terms of cytopenias? Did you give her growth factors?
This patient did develop cytopenias, and that was managed through dose reduction. After dose reduction, we did not need to use G-CSF for neutropenia.
Any GI issues, diarrhea?
She did not have any diarrhea. When she progressed, at this point, we introduced trastuzumab deruxtecan because of the HER2 low diagnosis. But my question to the faculty is, you know, if you saw a patient like this today, what would be your sequence of ADCs?
Yeah, well, now you've got Dato also as an option. How did she do on the T-DXd?
She did not do as well. There were more side effects and management was a little more difficult.
So actually, I misspoke because she's ER triple negative, so she wouldn't have Dato, at least not now, maybe in a couple of months, who knows. So again, Adam, I remember we did a CME program the day after the HER2 low data was first presented a few years ago at ASCO, and everybody was like, well, what are we going to do in terms of sequencing? And there we heard right then at that point that there was a lot of sentiment towards going with sacituzumab first. Now it's a few years versus T-DXd. I'm curious how you make that decision. Do you think the efficacy is the same or greater with one of these two? How do you think it through in triple negative disease, Adam?
Yeah, it's a good question. I think there's just a lot more data in triple negative disease with SG right now. That's really how I made the decision. I mean, I think Ascent, Didia can tell us, since he was the PI of the study, I think it was like 528 patients. Whereas DB04, they literally, it was kind of a post-hoc, almost a post-hoc kind of thing. That was intended as an ER-positive trial. They added 60 patients. They randomized 60 patients with triple negative disease. It was HER2 low to that. And as you know, in DB06, the ultra-low, there are no triple negative patients in the ultra-low in DB06. So there's not a lot of data with T-DXd in the triple negative area space. So I tend to use SG up front. I think probably all these agents are likely going to be very similar in their efficacy. The interesting thing is there are two major problems. Again, this brings us to the issue. The two major issues with this field, these drugs are great, but we have no data, no randomized clinical trial data of any kind, even phase two data of what happens after you progress on these agents. We have no idea, and we really don't have a good handle on resistance. And again, I'd love to pick Aditya's brain. We don't have time for it now on this call, what he thinks about the resistance mechanisms. We don't know, but I do know, and I think we all do know, that the limited data we have, at least from real-world analysis, is that the responses are modest when you sequence one after the other. And we have a couple of randomized trials like TRADE-DX and other things where we're trying to figure out in a randomized way whether there really is a benefit to the sequencing of these drugs.
So Aditya, any thoughts? Anything you want to say about these trials that are going to attempt to look at optimal sequencing? And also, any thoughts about, you know, this doc elected to do dose reduction for cytopenias. How do you decide between dose reduction and just keeping people on growth factors if they're doing well on growth factors?
Yeah, I agree with Adam. It was almost right. It was 529 patients, not 26 in
close.
The Ascent study.
Close.
It did show benefit with SG, and in general, that's the preferred drug. In terms of what to use after, we do see cross-resistance because of similar payloads between SG and T-DXd and Dato-DXd, and studies have described TOP1 mutations, so mutation in the site of where the payload binds, which can cause cross-resistance. So when I use the second ADC, similar to what was mentioned by Dr. Agarwal, you do see maybe more toxicity, but also less efficacy than what was seen in the clinical trials. So I usually get scans early after two cycles. I don't wait for three or four cycles when using the second ADC in this setting.
Yeah, Rosanna in the chat room bring up the issue of, you know, do you try to insert regular, you know, systemic chemo between the ADCs to maybe give the cells a chance to adjust differently? Let's go into another case. Again, gets into this issue of a lot of these patients with HER2 low get both TROP2, usually sacituzumab at this point, and TDXD, as this patient did of Dr. Ku. This is a 59-year-old woman, again, a triple-negative disease, who had disease progression on sacituzumab and then got TDXD. Here are her questions.
The questions that I have about this case have to do with thinking about these ADCs in sequencing. I think it's a very common clinical question of how do we sequence? Is it a viable strategy to try to do a sandwich approach, like an ADC chemo, then ADC later? Do we just expect that we're going to run into a lot of these side effects we see, like cytopenias, and just try our best to manage, think about dose reductions from the get-go? I would think that in her case, I would have loved to incorporate ctDNA as a way to better assess what's going on, instead of feeling like we were doing trial and error and then waiting for 3 months for another scan. We'd just love to be able to better predict that as we were going along. I'd be very curious to know how we can predict side effects from the get-go, because even though we have this thought of ADCs being novel, perhaps increasing our armamentarium of treatment options, it is still technically chemotherapy. And it would be interesting to do some type of like a prediction algorithm. Maybe that would be where AI comes in, like being able to create like a prediction signature based on a patient's multiple factors, and you put it together and see maybe they're not someone who's so appropriate for the risk of ILD from trastuzumab deruxtecan, for example. Maybe the bone marrow suppressive events are going to be more likely for certain patients just based on how their bone marrow indices already are.
So, Aditya, we're seeing so many AI-driven initiatives. I don't know whether that's been done with toxicity of various agents. I thought her idea was kind of interesting. Can AI put a bunch of factors in and give you an idea of like how much of a problem cytopenia or whatever might be? And also, any thoughts about sequencing in the ER-positive HER2-low situation? We talked about the triple-negative situation. But what about with ER positive? Now you have Dato as an option as well. So anybody doing any sort of AI-driven analyses of how to predict toxicity? And what about sequencing with ER positive disease?
And a great question. I've not seen any clinical data that would change practice per se, but definitely a lot of ongoing research looking at biomarkers, HER2, TROP2 expression, combined expression in terms of sequencing of these drugs. For ER-positive disease, I usually use the opposite sequence. Start with TDXD as long as a patient has HER2-low or ultra-low disease, which is the majority. And then after that, then the options are SG, Dato-DXD. Each one has their advantages, disadvantages. SG, day one, day eight, more side effect of diarrhea and neutropenia. Dato-DXD every 3 weeks, but more side effect of mucositis and keratitis. So discussing with the patient. And then this chemo sandwich technique is interesting, whether you bring chemo in between ADC. I'm curious to hear quickly from Adam as well. I personally generally don't use chemo sandwich technique. I use them back to back.
Adam?
Yeah, I don't understand the science behind sandwiching. I mean, I'm assuming it's to allow the recirculation of the antibody or something like that. You know, maybe that's one of the resistance mechanisms. Again, we don't, yes, there are TOPO1 mutations and insertions actually in TROP2, but we don't really understand resistance of these agents. We do know that about a quarter of people will have a response of some sort, 20, 25% will respond in sequence. We just don't know who those 25% are, 20% are. And I agree, maybe, you know, now that we've gathered an enormous amount of data, we have large real-world databases, maybe an AI could help us out with this. I think it'll be really interesting to see what happens going forward.
So we're going to go to one final case of a patient, of a doc I talked to, but I see in the chat room, Uzoma has a case where it said, this is a current patient, I'm stuck on what to do next. So you can help out this doc in a second. But first, I want you to hear about this 63-year-old woman. This is ER positive or HER2 low, what we were just talking about. And this patient actually got T-DXd. We're not going to get into it. I'm actually save this part for another. When we get to the webinar on tolerability of ER agents, Adidia. But interestingly, this lady, she said, oh, she was on Capi fulvestrant for 3 months, didn't do very well, had a lot of hyperglycemia. And I was like, oh, really? I haven't heard too much about it. I said, what was the hemoglobin A1C when you started it? And this patient who had not previously been diagnosed with diabetes, hemoglobin A1C was 7.2. And then she got the Capi and all hell broke loose. So we'll get into more about how to handle that. We're thinking about doing diabetology 101 for oncologists because of cases like this. Let's hear what happened with this patient.
Patient is currently doing well on T-DXd and has had a good response to therapy so far.
And what kind of toxicity tolerability issues have come up?
So she's done really well with it. She actually is not required a dose reduction at this point. She's around cycle 6 of T-DXd. She's had no evidence of ILD and a little bit of fatigue and nausea, but which are manageable with supportive therapies. I think the really important point is how we think about that next line of therapy. There's a lot of discussion about whether to follow DESTINY-Breast06 or to go first to chemo, as that does tend to be better tolerated. We're thinking about capecitabine. So I'd be interested to hear from the faculty how they are thinking about this line of therapy, specifically chemotherapy or T-DXd based on the DESTINY-Breast06 data.
At the time she was treated with the T-DXd, did she have symptoms from the disease? Did she have a lot of disease?
She had some more disease compared to when we switched her to the Capi, but she was having some bone pain from the disease, asymptomatic from the disease in the lungs. And she, the reason that we picked T-DXd for her was that she really wanted as fast of a response as we could get, and we felt that this might be our better option to start with.
So what happened to her bone pain once you started the T-DXd?
So she's had a little bit of improvement in the bone pain. We did have follow-up scans that show an improvement in that area on her scan. So she is feeling better. She, again, dealing with some fatigue and nausea, but very manageable.
So I want to get to the case from the chat room. But Adidia, in what situations, if any, would you like to use T-DXd before capecitabine? This patient needed a response.
Yeah, in general, patients who are symptomatic, patients who have visceral disease, patients with liver metastases, in all those settings, in general, I would prioritize T-DXd based on DESTINY-Breast06. And the opposite, if someone has bone-only disease, that was only 3% of patients in DESTINY-Breast06, and maybe in that setting, asymptomatic bone mets, capecitabine could be reasonable drug to start with.
All right, Adam, here's a case that the doc would like some help with. 37-year-old woman with widely metastatic and symptomatic, triple negative, but IHC 2 plus, so HER2 low, diagnosed in the third trimester of the second pregnancy, PD-L1 80%, TMB 23, HRD positive, but no genetic abnormalities, deliver the baby. No response to a Pembro Carbo Gem, and also progressed after sacituzumab. She wants to know what's next. Would you consider T-DXd in this situation? What about a PARP inhibitor based on her HRD positivity?
So the first thing, there's a lot. This is a tough case. This is a very, very tough case. I think a lot of us, I'm curious what you would say, would probably try T-DXd. Not expecting a huge response, but I think that's probably most people's next move. I think that, you know, again, only 20-25% of people will have some sort of response, ADC after ADC. She's already been through the best chemo we have, Carbo-Gem and Carbo-Gem and Pembro, as well as Sasi. You could maybe get away with single-agent chemotherapy, maybe with a taxane. I didn't hear her getting a taxane. She hasn't had that yet. That could be a possibility, or Ribulin. But I think that in terms of the HRD positivity, right now I would not treat someone with a PARP inhibitor based on HRD alone. I think that still we have no data on that yet. Hopefully one day when we get a better HRD assay, we'll have better data for that. I would not treat with a PARP. I think most of us likely in this young woman would reach for a TDXD, but I think single agent chemos of some other side would be the other alternative. that's how I would manage this.
Didi, any thoughts?
And I agree. It should be remembered that TDXT has deruxtecan, which does, you know, have activity if there's alteration in the HRD pathway. And we saw this at ASCO that in patients with germline or somatic BRCA mutation, the activity of TDXT was higher. So I would feel comfortable using TDXT as mentioned by Adam.
So another issue, I was mentioning the fact that all these docs, nobody had a HER2-0 patient. Another thing that was kind of interesting, I was mentioning to the faculty before, is just tremendous concerns about ILD with TDXD really has gotten into people's head, and I think justifiably now, particularly now we're talking about using a localized disease. But I'm just curious, Aditya, how do you view, you know, for example, Dato-DXD, and would Dato be a consideration? Would you ever consider Dato in a patient who had prior SASE, like this patient that came from the chat room? And to what extent does Dato cause ILD? I think you mentioned it as a side effect, but it seems much less than a TDXD. You know, you hear about the HER2 receptors in the lung. How much of an issue is of ILD is it with Dato? Aditya, any thoughts about this case? Would you ever use Dato after SASE?
The answer is yes, and there's data from the phase 1 study where patients who had received prior SG, there was activity with Dato-DXT. So I would consider that when we are running out of option. The incidence of ILD is lower than TDXT, but it's not zero. Studies showed, you know, 2 to 4% risk of ILD as compared to 10 to 15% with TDXT.
All right. Well, it's been a very quick hour, one of the quickest ones I can remember in a while. And I really appreciate the docs who gave us cases here today. We've presented literally, I think, close to 5,000 cases now since the pandemic. And it's just such a revelation to hear these docs in practice. And just talking to them, I'll sit down with them for, you know, an hour and a half going through, you know, CLL, myeloma. I mean, in every part of oncology, bladder cancer, you know, we see so many encouraging, but a lot of stuff to digest. So kudos to the docs in practice. Aditya and Adam, thank you so much for joining us today. Audience, be safe, stay well, and have a great night. Thanks so much, Aditya. Thanks, Adam.
Thank you.
Thank you.